This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Acoustic Territories, Sound, Culture, and Everyday Life, a performative reading by artist Brandon LaBelle from his book of the same title. It took place on June 11th, 2010.
Considering this is a noise, sound event, maybe exploring the electronic devices can be part of the project. Okay. Yeah, no, really, it's great to be here and, of course, to come and present my new book and celebrate its release. As you can imagine, it's a ton of work and... So it's nice to take a moment and have a few drinks and enjoy it becoming a material object that you can then take with you and bring it home, and it can participate in your everyday life. So that's a kind of real pleasure as a writer, of course, when that moment happens. And of course, everyday life is a kind of theme for the book. And generally, I mean, I can just maybe say a few things, just sort of generally about what really sort of excites me or makes me feel involved in sound as a material, as a theme, as a practice. Working as an artist and as a writer, sound, I guess, has become a kind of entire sort of context or sort of field of investigation. So sound, I guess, for me, provides a number of opportunities to kind of think through or explore particular issues, or, of course, just to maybe on a personal level to kind of sort of question or find a place for myself in and amongst the world. So sound is a kind of platform on a number of levels for me. And I guess what really... somehow drives me towards sound as a topic is, of course, the way in which it pervades and circulates through everyday life, through our kind of individual trajectories and experiences. So sound is a kind of material, a kind of phenomenon that's sort of ever-present and that comes to us in different ways. Some, of course, very unconsciously, others more articulated. So the way in which sound is kind of circulating around us for me becomes a very intriguing and exciting kind of project to then kind of look at and be curious about. What are the kinds of experiences that it gives us? How do we use sound? What kind of meanings does it take on for us? And of course, sound gets channeled through different kinds of cultural expressions. So of course, music is a very sort of dynamic and fundamental sound, particularly in terms of everyday life. And of course, things like the voice as a very, also a very kind of meaningful and significant sound, for me also is a very kind of amazing topic to look at or to listen to, I might say. So the ways in which sound exists and becomes meaningful really is a kind of topic that pervades and that inspires my practice. And I guess maybe just sort of one point I could sort of underscore a bit is I feel like once I start kind of investigating sound or taking sound on as a theme, as a field of examination, I'm always struck by the fact or by the proposal really that sound starts to, for me, redraw the lines between the private and the public. And this is a kind of topic that I tried to explore in the new book. So somehow I feel that this notion of the private and the public, that once you kind of say those words, I mean, even that kind of dichotomy for me is deeply flawed. But we say those words and there's a feeling that there's a kind of line between them. You know, there's some kind of clear division. And I feel that in my work with sound and sort of taking sound on as a topic, these things, of course, become very unclear. So I feel that sound is something that is immediately something very personal, very intimate, that sound comes to us and enters our body and becomes something for us, while at the same time it's something also immediately shared and collective. So that this sound coming to me is also something that's overheard by someone else as a proposal, as a suggestion. So the way in which sound moves across borders, that it doesn't remain kind of tied to particular objects or bodies, it's always kind of leaving those things behind. It emanates from objects and bodies to kind of circulate in these surprising ways. So sound, of course, is promiscuous, yes, and it flirts with everyone. And it finds friends, and of course it makes enemies. And this, of course, is for me what it really offers, what it offers us, and maybe it's also how we use it. To be in a very kind of immediate and direct way to have relationships. So sound is, for me, as you can tell, a very multifaceted topic. But one thing that I try to do, I guess, in the new publication is to take these topics, these questions of privacy and publicness, of different kinds of cultural expressions where sound is kind of very dynamically there, and in a way map them in a very diaristic way. So I feel a bit that the new publication is secretly a diary. It doesn't appear as a diary, but it's really a diary of a listener. So I sort of took it upon myself to try to assess and survey a bit different kinds of territories, different kinds of spaces, different kinds of locations, just try to, in a way, notate how sound is operating there. And in doing that, though, I found immediately that I was led to so many things outside of sound. So that starting with sound suddenly was to end up with things like cars, or to end up with things like marching bands, or to end up with kind of dreams and hallucinations and buried histories and kind of obscure knowledges. So I felt that this was actually, in the end, I thought, of course, this is kind of perfect, because sound, of course, as a promiscuous itinerant movement, it's always connecting with more than itself. Sound is, in a way, never itself, and it's always something more than what appears to be. So I sort of felt that, in a way, this associative structure, or this kind of associative project in the end, was very telling, or very sort of suggestive of actually how sound kind of already is behaving. So the publication took these kind of itineraries, you might say, and tried to follow sound, and in doing so bumped into a lot of other topics, other themes. But in the end, what I tried to do also was to structure each chapter around what I like to think of as a sonic figure. So each chapter is a kind of site or a territory, such as the underground or the shopping mall. Those kind of sites or locations are investigated or described through different sonic figures, meaning things like vibration, echo, resonance, feedback, transmission. So these kind of sonic, they almost became kind of sonic metaphors, but also kind of sonic behaviors. So I felt that they were kinds of characters or kind of figures. So I sort of took these characters and, in a way, tried to use them to investigate the particular site. So the underground became very much about the echo these sorts of things. So there's a kind of vocabulary, a kind of sonic vocabulary that I try to develop in describing or in mapping the different territories, these different kind of sites within everyday life. So what I kind of thought for this evening was that to read a text. So I developed a text in a way to try to elaborate these sonic figures. So I took three of them. I thought in a way I wanted to pay more attention to them specifically. Excuse me. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, thank you. So I'm going to read this text. And then, of course, afterwards, it's perfectly fine if we want to chat a bit more, or I can say a few things more, or we can just hang out. Okay. Rhythm. I told my drum teacher I didn't want to use a metronome. That endless ticking, tick, 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 keeping time. I thought to myself, drums are not really about keeping time. I did not want to keep time, to hold it. I wanted to let it go, finally. I wanted a metaphysical experience, something meaningful, something about I and you, a kind of connection. I thought this could be important, that is, drumming. I didn't know exactly what this would be. At the age of 13, I only felt the need for something more, something transformative, a new body. I was searching for what occurs between the beats, in between the tick, 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 escape, transgression. So we got rid of the metronome. In its place, instead, I and you. That began to feel like something, a breath, raindrops. But then my drum teacher, well, he gave up on me. Guess I couldn't manage the drum rolls. But I went ahead on my own, which was probably better. Instead of the tick, I went for the thump. I thought this could be a place to start, a beginning of something different. Not the tick of school days or the tick of family life, but something more dramatic, intuitive. I wanted the thump. You see, the tick is like the endless rhythm, the structure, the stable referent. As a contrast, the thump, well, that's the disruption, the thing that stands out, the contrast, the cut, the break, an odd rhythm. The thump might be understood to pose a problem. It delivers what lies outside the frame, brings it inside. The thump is the beginning of negotiation. The tick may be what brings us here at a certain time, but the thump is what marks this time as a rhythm in the making. What I'm trying to get at are the dynamics of rhythm. The cultural theorist Henri Lefebvre proposes that rhythm is made from the intersection of space, time, and energy. That in the contact of these three elements, rhythm is generated. For me, this is rather abstract. I miss the concrete, the specificity. Instead, I'd say that rhythm is born from the meeting of different orders, like with walking. I walk down the street, and in this moment of the foot hitting the ground, a sort of rhythm emerges. It comes alive there under the feet. To move the whole body one step at a time, from here to there, along the many surfaces that mark this space. The order of the body meeting the order of the street. The full force of this materiality falling down onto the structure of the city. To tease each other, to push against each other, and in whose friction, whose contact, a beat comes forward. Walking may form such an imaginative form of presence, from Thoreau's Wandering in the Woods, or Baudelaire's Urban Drifts, or the psychogeographic project of the Situationists. These walking poetics ultimately point toward the dynamics of rhythm, of the possibility of the foot beating out its own tempo. The walk is that very point of everyday life where two orders continually meet as an endless tension or drama between myself here and this place there to form a horizon of modulation, change, energy. Rhythm is a state of negotiation, two things meeting, the tick and the thump, you and I. Such rhythmical exchanges can already be glimpsed on the Millennium Bridge in London during its opening ceremony in the year 2000. As an event, the bridge opening attracted thousands of citizens to tread across its length, spanning the Thames, creating a dramatic and noticeable wobble. Is there audio? Maybe he's having a cigarette. It's okay. Did you get that? It's okay. Sound is elusive. The wobbling bridge, in fact, brings forward the walk as a rhythm generated from that instant of the body hitting the pavement, further announced by the Bee Gees in the opening lines to Saturday Night Fever. Well, you can tell by the way I use my walk, I'm a woman's man, no time to talk. Music loud and women warm, I've been kicked around since I was born, and now it's all right, it's okay. It's okay precisely because the walk forms a vocabulary of potential escape, individuality, new forms of subjectivity, always in the making and on the way to somewhere. Walking is the promise of heading places, of being elsewhere, of making a new path.
Stay alive. Can you guys do that way?
As long as it don't turn into a 20-year mortgage.
All right, look. Put me down $5 for that blue shirt in the window. Hold it for me.
Hey, wait for your receipt. Please don't trust me.
What I like about this scene is how completely the body, the music, and the city all come together. Tony's walk is dynamic, suggestive, sexy. It literally transforms the street to his own making. The street seems to flow around him, supporting his desires, his appetites, his fantasies. Tony hits the street, and in doing so, he carves out his own particular rhythm. A movement that includes, in its beat, acts of eating pizza, buying shirts, and checking out the chicks. As Tony demonstrates, the walk is propulsion, confrontation, and erotic confidence all in one, pure rhythm. In the film, of course, the walk is but one step towards the disco, where rhythm then becomes fully charged with a clash of orders between belonging and escape, between family and friends, between the neighborhood and the future. The disco is the scene where rhythm becomes a full beating drama. But I want to take a step back toward the street again as that space where the foot hits the pavement to send ripples up the legs and also downward back into the city. Tony's walk meets the order of the city not only in what is possible for him there in the neighborhood, but also in the infrastructures that give pace to certain rhythms. Though the film never shows it, at some point during Tony's walk, he must have found himself at a crosswalk. Crosswalks break the flow of the city as a space of free movement. They interrupt the force of the free walker, fully locating the poetics of walking back into the grid of the urban system. The crosswalk reintroduces the tick onto the field of the thumping body. It reorders walking, locking one into a system of measurements, the starting and stopping of traffic, a rhythm of waiting. Crosswalks are the ultimate time signature of the urban system. The crosswalk coerces the body with its repetition, its signaling. It operates as a line around which the walk circulates and into which the body falls in and out of alignment. One steps in line, falls behind, or runs over this patterning to formulate a counterpoint, a break or slippage, always on the verge of shifting the tempo. Walking is a percussive act that beats back the patterns and orders to find place within and through the rhythms that surround us. Let's return to the tick and the thump, to the drama unfolding between the metronome and the drum. While I embraced the drum as a possible escape, as a route towards rupture and transformation, the drum may also be understood as an instrument of ordering. It places emphasis on timing, repetition. It fixes the body into a regimented structure. It lays down the order by which others must follow. Whether in the hammering found on slave ships or in the beats of the military, the timing of the drum is a powerful instrument. Against this measurement performed by the drum, the walk can easily become a march. The drum brings the walk in line to a deeper beat, locating one step into a particular grip. To march is to enter into the collective force of a rhythmical machine. It turns the organic fluctuations of poetical walking into the energy grid of power. Such power can be found in the city of Bergen on the west coast of Norway, whose tradition of military drumming takes the shape of social clubs for young boys. Derived from militias who defended neighborhoods in the city throughout the 18th century, the young boys formed their own clubs as a way to mimic their military fathers, trading in guns for drums to fill the streets of the city with their punctuated marching. The drumming boys parade the streets during National Day on May 17th, displaying their emerging masculinity for all to see and to hear. The drum, the march, the beat, all come to suggest an order at the heart of national history. Rhythm here forcefully carries tradition toward a future society. Yet the drum and the march, like the walker confronting the crosswalk, are always prone to slippage and territorial dispute. The military boys may also utilize the drum and the beat as a gift, as a force to celebrate the coming of the new. We should not forget the story of the little drummer boy, whose drumming was but the sole means by which to honor the new Messiah, a king born in the manger amongst the cud and the mud of a social order soon to change. In this way, every drum, every beat, every rhythm is a violence, bringing pain and pleasure together, teaching us how to find place and also how to redefine, reorganize, or disrupt existing patterns. Rhythm is then not as innocent as it may first appear.
Bye.
vibration. The passing of a subway train underground, below the floor of a cafe where I sit and have soup. A small vibration traveling up through the floor, along the metal base of the table, to arrive finally onto the plane of the table. A sensation caught just under my arm as it rests on the edge, a marble edge tickling my arm with a train many meters below in a vast network of frictions and contacts, to touch my skin and land against the surface of my bones. All these sensations send shivers across the flesh, making it dance to a rather unknown sonic source. The ripples of vibration that tunnel through the body, across the floor, up the walls, to tickle the skin of architecture with multiple agitations. Might vibration draw an altogether different understanding of a body in a space? To bring them together, along with all the materiality hovering here and there, in a unified plane of excitement. I'm thinking of the skin, or I'm following the skin as a surface marked and plucked by the soft agitations of your breath, his footsteps, their laughter. The skin is touched by all that energy here and there, from across the room and from underneath, at all times. Such instances might form a primary vocabulary for locating the self in the midst of so much surrounding, to register who or what is around as forces and undulations to drive one away or further in. Vibration is rhythm maximized, brought against the body to a point of sensation. It is a territory not of the step or the walk, but of the skin. The skin is a big ear, like a bodysuit wrapped and tucked, folded in and over, to form a vague but highly sensitive surface of feeling. It is the literal sensing of all that passes across oneself and all that hovers just below, under the fingertips or behind the chest, on the inside of the skin. There are certain songs that send the skin shivering in a medley of goosebumps that tickle the back of the neck, soften the beat of the heart, and make the muscles ripple in a wave of sensual weightlessness. There are songs for the heart, and there are songs for the skin. These skin songs, though, find an additional home within the automobile. Get in and sit back, turn the key, and hit the open road. The car is an extra skin, touching and being acted upon by all the energy born from material contact. A second skin that sends vibrations back against the driving body to drive additional energy and force deep down, impelling and propelling one toward new heights of power and of sensing. Behind the wheel, one is enveloped in a plenitude of vibration, where all surfaces conspire and assemble in sensual formation to touch the skin with extra force. The second skin of the car is also a site for new forms of cultural identity, resistance, enforcement, as a surface upon which law and outlaw meet. As numerous car chase scenes depict, the car is a radical machine for criminal behavior, as well as lawful order. The two interweave to a point where it is hard to know who is who as they go veering off the road, plunge into gorges, or destroy entire neighborhoods with their bursts of metallic dedication. Car culture is a definite territory for the construction of identity. From hot rods to lowriders, cars function as devices to rewrite the ordering of particular skins. The lowrider is one such example. The lowrider is a modified and customized object crafted to deliver the particulars of a certain cultural identity. It is a space for the enactment of racial pride, where the skin of the body is amplified to the skin of the car to announce particular messages. With the introduction of mega-bass sound systems into lowriders, the signifying movements of such statements become a booming throb. The added sonic beat to the customized car occupies the street, contouring the pinstripe or the leopard upholstery with the force of the subwoofer. The car is then also a drum, a skin stretched to deliver the beat as street culture on wheels, with megabass a new form of social statement. Megabass is a tool for the production of an expanded skin, placing all the vibration under the seat of the driver, as well as blasting it outward through double 15-inch subwoofers driven by four amplifiers locked into the trunk. Such funked productions no doubt give force to the already existing beats found at the heart of hip-hop, filling Public Enemy's Fight the Power with added boost, throb, and violating decibel to mark the street with the pounding of the funky drummer, as they announce, "Music hitting your heart, cause I know you got soul, brothers and sisters, hey. Listen if you're missing y'all, swinging while I'm singing, giving what you getting, knowing what I know. While the black band's sweating and the rhythm rhymes rolling, got to give us what we want, got to give us what we need. Our freedom of speech is freedom or death. We got to fight the powers that be. Let me hear you say, fight the power." Beats, in other words, that turn the history of beaten bodies into counterattack. This blending of beats and roads finds its own brand of hip-hop in the form of Jeep beats from the early 90s, designed around the cultivation of the Jeep vehicle, notably the Suzuki Jeep. As the track listing to Bassman's Jeep Beats from 1995 demonstrates, the potential of cars is not only found in style, but in the boom of vibration. Tracks such as Intro to Boom, Bass Pie, Deep Thrust, Doo-Doo Bass, It Takes Two, the Bass Pneumatic Duo, Bass in Your System, Bass Dog, Bass Junkies, Here Comes the Bass, Quake of the Month, Trunk Shakers. Jeep Beats constructs a bass language. Bass culture also finds expression in DB drag racing, where the automobile is turned into an object for curious sport. Developed over the last 10 years, DB drag racing, also known as bass racing or sound pressure level competitions, is a competitive sport utilizing the automobile as an acoustical shell by which to race bass frequencies. Competitors customize their cars for optimum sound pressure levels, often eliminating elements from the car, filling car doors with cement, and packing the trunk with an array of amplifiers. The competition is designed to reach sound levels over 170 decibels. In 2005, Scott Owens became the first person to break the 180 decibels barrier with his Ford vehicle. Sponsored by Pioneer Audio, Owens' car was fitted using 13 Pioneer subwoofers powered by 52 Premier amplifiers. Such incredible power produced a sound equivalent to that of a rocket launching. Such extremes, of course, make the car totally uninhabitable, turning the customized mega-bass sound system into an elaborate technical intervention. Vibration then turns space into a connective membrane where all points of contact ripple with energy. Vibration might be understood to force together disparate elements, to mend existing breaks, to create the beginnings of commonality. Against the tactility of vibration, all distances become potential means for being touched. Vibration, in other words, is the life of the skin, where not only the force of megabass takes hold, but also an array of delicate and gentle caresses perform. The skin shivers with your caress. My heart sends vibrations through my veins. The vibe of this scene is something to catch as an atmosphere that conditions how we might find ourselves as one among many. Echo. I'm thinking of Richard Serra's Boomerang piece from 1974. the artist places a microphone in front of a woman. The woman wears headphones and can hear her speaking voice, though delayed. Her voice comes back to her slightly behind her speaking. The woman speaks, talks about this experience. She refers to the situation, tries to describe what she is hearing, and how this echoing, this device disrupts her speech, her conscious thought.
Echo. And the words are coming back on top of me. The words are spilling out of my head and then returning into my ear. It puts a distance between the words. And their apprehension or their comprehension. The words coming back seem slow. They don't seem to have the same forcefulness as when I speak them.
I think it's also slowing me down.
I think that it makes my thinking slower. I have a double take on myself. I am once removed from myself. I am thinking and hearing and filling up a vocal void. I find that I have trouble making connections between thoughts.
I think that the words forming in my mind are somewhat detached from my normal thinking process.
I have the feeling that I am not where I am. I feel that this place is removed from reality.
Sarah's boomerang starts to say everything about the echo. It puts on display the embedded dynamics of echoing sound. As the woman states, it's as if she leaves her own body, is stranger to herself, with her voice coming back to her, as if from another reality. Everything staggers within the movements of the echo. The echo is the beginning of change. It takes the moment of a sound and repeats it, expanding beyond the original event and also returning it. The echo is sound becoming other to itself. It ultimately threatens to undo the stability of all forms of origins and relation of oneself. In other words, it disorients. The echo then is the beginning of difference. As with the acquisition of speech, that instant of a parent mouthing words to a child, opening mouth and parting lips, as an invitation or suggestion for the child to follow, words flow as an echo. The child responds, mirrors back what it hears, to place the parent's words in its own mouth. The words come back to the parent suddenly in a moment of wonder and glee, as from another. They return as an echo, and in doing so bring not the parent's voice, but a differentiating break. The echo stages the beginning of a relation, where origin splinters and fragments to take up a diversity of trajectories. How many times the echo, in all its reverberating energy, becomes other to its own origin, to come back as a monster, a voice in the dark, to frighten the one who speaks, so they pause, hesitate, suddenly to wonder who is there. Whereas vibration initiates a flow of commonality, the beginning of contact, one to the other, the echo brings forward difference to remind ourselves that we are not who we think we are, that even our own voice as that personal energy that rises up from deep inside may also turn against us. I want to take the essential operations of the echo and extend it, to follow the echo as a sonic event that unfurls to disrupt, confuse, and disorient. Not only perception and the performance of the self, but also as a greater cultural sound. In other words, to see the echo as a form of practice. Such echoing practices may be found in the example of the Mexican perforation. The Mexican perforation is an underground collective operating to occupy underground chambers and spaces throughout the city of Paris. The underground for the Mexican perforation is a space that, in being hidden from terrestrial light, allows for the imagining and staging of a secret society, one that in turn remains critical of all that lies above. To go underground, then, is to consciously echo, to mirror society. In doing so, to disorient and undo the particular organization of earthly life. To go underground is to cultivate difference, resistance, a second society as the echo of the first. One such action performed by the Mexican perforation was the mounting of secret film screenings directly underneath the Cinémathèque Française in Paris. Discovered by the police in 2004, the underground chamber contained film projectors, a library of various films from the 50s, as well as a collection of horror films, a kitchen, and other appliances powered through appropriated electricity lines. As Lazar Kuntzman, spokesman for the group, stated, "The Mexican perforation is a group of urban explorers whose members have more than 20 years' experience. Transforming places is what they do every day, so making a cinema was an easy thing to organize." Located underneath the Cinémathèque, the underground cinema sought to operate as a counter space to the official above-ground cinema, to literally occupy the inverse image of the Cinémathèque. Such echoing practices were even elaborated in their film programming, which was organized as a comment to the films being shown in the cinema above ground. The underground cinema, in mirroring the culture above, aimed to subvert established culture, carving out a space for alternative viewing. The echo is then enacted as a conscious supplement. It announces a relation to its own origin, and in doing so, enacts a form of haunting. The echo may be a form of opposition, critique, as well as radical incorporation. The echo, then, is a sort of threat. It reminds of the very possibility that our actions may in fact return to become greater than ourselves, that what lies in open view in turn contains an unseen underground full of clandestine force. The echo is our own alter ego that may at some point take independent shape. The voice in the dark that suddenly comes back to send one trembling might be heard as a monster, the echo as a double that mirrors back one's own dark self. Such doubling, of course, finds its ultimate narrative in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, with Jekyll as the respectable citizen and Hyde as the nefarious echo, the double that gives expression to Jekyll's desire for a being without conscience, one free from moral structure, able to delve into the darkness that haunts the social order. That Jekyll and Hyde are in fact the same person, the same body, gives ready evidence that doubling is an essential performance of the self. The Jekyll and Hyde split gives expression to a set of fundamental fears and fantasies, unpacking the core of human existence as held between conscious act and unconscious desire, between the terrestrial moral structure and the formless shadowy flood of hidden drives. The echo then may be heard as a channel by which the two may meet, a sort of medium bringing Jekyll and Hyde into contact to ultimately disorient the fixity and certainty of both. The voice in the dark, though, finds its ultimate horror in the image of the ventriloquist dummy. The uncanny throwing of the voice turns the inanimate form of the dummy into a ghostly image. Whose voice is that arising from the scene? The moving mouth of the dummy comes to fix the voice as its own, bringing on to its wooden shape a sense of animate life. In doing so, the dummy and the ventriloquist form an intimate couple, where one mirrors the other, saying what the other may have said or what the other hoped to say. The dummy, in effect, is the ventriloquist's conscience. It allows the ventriloquist to cross moral lines, to speak out of place, to flirt, and in some places, to kill, as in the classic film Dead of the Night. Or later, in the Batman comics, where a character by the name of the ventriloquists uses his dummy named Scarface, which in cases appears as a giant robot, to do his ghastly acts of criminality. The echo then may be heard as the beginning of criminality, of haunting, of differentiating otherness, an instant of the breaking of the body seams to unleash that which hovers just below the skin. The echo is a sound leaving the world behind to suggest new horizons and new forms of intimacy. As Tony Visconti's treatment of David Bowie's voice on the track Heroes may reveal, the echo is introduced to support the voice as it calls for the other, as it aims for the clouds and the possibility of reaching across distance. Bowie's voice progressively expands as if transported onto another, more ethereal plane, until by the end his shouts seem to call from an unseen distance to prick my ear.
Dolphins.
stop there. Thanks. Thank you, Sina. Thank you.
If there are questions, we can pass the mic around. I'm going to turn on the lights.
Okay.
So it seems to me that there is a subtext
about masculinity throughout the whole piece. And one of the things I was thinking, especially in the first part with the disco, is that some of the discourses surrounding disco in the 70s had to do with masculine anxieties for two reasons. One, that the kind of mechanical, robotic beats of disco were sort of, let's just say, for lack of a better word, castrating to the sort of more kind of rock and roll thing that was going on in the 50s and 60s. There was also a discourse going on that disco somehow was kind of challenged traditional forms of masculinity because of the fact that it killed the FM DJ, right? Because it at the same time disco came in, certain forms of computerized playlists came in, a sort of more managerial bean counting form of radio station control rather than the sort of free form FM DJ masculinity of the 60s. So, you know, I'm wondering, you know, seeing the John Travolta, whether or not Saturday Night Fever was the killer app to actually make disco palatable for kind of sort of more standard masculine roles rather than more queer sexualities of the 70s. You know, it seems like to have a working class Brooklyn guy be into disco seems to be a way to merge all the resentment that was surrounding disco into a more mainstream, you know, thing. And I think the reason that I asked this question, because it seems to be all around the question of rhythm, that there was something about the standardization of rhythm that seemed to threaten a form of quote-unquote authentic masculinity.
Mm. Well, thanks for your comments, really. I mean, it's definitely a topic that I'm curious about, and also coming upon the sort of Saturday Night Fever kind of example was something that kind of sparked my imagination, and I wanted to sort of look at that, and I have been curious to sort of, explore that in more detail, but as you can see, I mean, I touch upon it quite lightly, and but it does make me wonder a little bit too about glam rock, you know, and I mean, there's certainly, you know, the way in which masculinity gets kind of performed in that sort of scene. You know, running parallel to disco or kind of, you know, overlapping with disco. I mean, certainly there's a kind of interesting maybe kind of way to look at the sort of larger cultural picture of the 70s in relationship to shifts in masculinity, particularly if you think about the kind of challenges of the 60s in terms of the civil rights movement and the kind of Vietnam War, and the way in which the notion of the hero, the soldier, the president, all these kind of incredibly iconic masculine imagery that gets totally shattered at that moment in time, leading into the 70s of kind of, you know, ambiguity, really. You know, it just makes me, just as a kind of train of thought, really. But I certainly appreciate your kind of focus on that. And I mean, there is masculinity, I mean, not to sort of go off on too large a tangent, but it's definitely a project that I would like to explore, actually, in relationship to some of these topics around sound, to actually take that on as a, you know, this sort of question of gender or, you know, what is sound in relationship to those particular kind of issues. To say, for instance, you know, how is listening conditioned by the specific body that is involved in that moment, you know. Thank you.
Hello.
Hey, Keiko.
Hi. Unfortunately, I missed the first part, but I came in from the beginning of the vibration. And my comment, question, whatever it is, is about the third part, echo. I thought you took many of the examples in parallel, echo with the kind of like, you know, the above ground, like hidden ground, yeah. And you know, the bright part and shadow, that kind of you know, the mirrored images and stuff like that. Yeah. But you know, this certain thing I have been curious about the Confucian Chinese and also like Japanese. I'm Japanese, really influenced. And there's a part, shadow of shadow, somewhere in between the gray part, and that's where the monsters popping up. And I'm very curious about this. You know, I'm not particularly interested like this very apparent contrast in between those things. And then there should be certain kind of thing and existing in the very gray area. Mm-hmm. And primarily, you know, what I'm working on, you know, as a sound artist is feedback, because feedback is like, you know, that's producing somewhere very gray. Between the initiator and it's something reflected. And I don't know if you have any kind of comments about those things.
No, certainly. I mean, I think there's also a kind of literary verve that, you know, these kind of oppositional tensions are kind of very seductive in terms of immediately kind of writing a kind of narrative, so that the kind of conflict between opposites, you know, is a kind of very literary kind of function to drive narrative. So I know I get carried away a little bit with the echo, in terms of bringing these forces like in opposition. Like there's a kind of immediate friction there, that this doubling or this mirroring back and forth. But I think ultimately maybe what I'm maybe as you point out, I mean, there is this kind of moment where the echo maybe is that sort of kind of middle, more grayish area where the two are really in contact and kind of interwoven more so than being strictly polar opposites. And the echo is the thing that moves back and forth. So, for instance, it can also deliver, you know, benevolence or, you know, something much more positive, you know, in that sense, or at the same time be also the evil other, you know. So it would be something to, again, maybe try to, create more space for, to go further with that. But for this, I sort of couldn't resist the literary moment of the
Sure, I enjoyed those examples, especially Cinémathèque Francis. Underneath there was another Cinémathèque, kind of, you know, the hidden Cinémathèque, Mexican, I forgot the name of the group. But I just thought about that. And of course, you know, that's just coming out of the pharmacon kind of Platon. Thing, and then, you know, the shadow and the original thing, and of course, you know, those kind of things are bringing back, like, you know, questioning, but it is an interesting subject to think about, like echo and, you know, how it works, how the, like in not only echo, literal echo of sound, but also like echo in general, in the concept.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate that you brought that up.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have a question about another gray area between the term rhythm and vibration. Do you draw a rather sharp line, or is it is there like a big gray area of overlap between those terms?
Yeah. Well, of course, I mean, it's not an exact science. Of course, the two are, you know, touch each other, certainly. And I'm not trying to make such very, you know, clear kind of lines around these topics or around these themes. So I'm certainly open to the idea of them, you know, overlapping or one becoming the other, or where is it hard to kind of delineate the two. So if you had any thoughts about that, I certainly welcome them. I mean, were you thinking there's a kind of relationship there?
I was curious about like what the actual difference in definition between rhythm and vibration would be.
Yeah.
If vibration involves the sensation and rhythm is more like the outside movement or something, but it, to me it seems so interleaved that it's just hard to grasp. And I was curious where you would make this difference between those two terms.
Yeah. I mean, certainly for me, the two definitely suggest kind of forms of contact. So that vibration as this kind of palpable energy that forces things together. So for instance, you know, vibration moving through the floor here, through the table and then onto my arms, suddenly there's a very there's a kind of integration between myself and the floor suddenly. So there's actually no difference, you might suggest, between this materiality and this materiality. And so vibration for me was very much about this, the kind of idea of commonality or the idea of the shared. So this kind of integration of all things into one that vibration seems to kind of propose. And also our experience of vibration is very palpable in that way. So I was thinking very much about this physicality of vibration, this sensuality, and the skin as part of that material event, part of that experience. Whereas rhythm somehow seemed to me to suggest something, you know, there's a contact there, but there's also a kind of, you know, the percussive act is also somehow about patterns and organization, and somehow the beat brings different kinds of things, brings things into a certain order, while at the same time providing us with the opportunity or the material, the medium to also transform that pattern. So the beat is also something we're modulating, you know, that we're the percussive act is some kind of you know, following in line or breaking. So for me, rhythm somehow was somehow a little bit more political, somehow a little bit more ideological. You know, it was about particular orders or systems of organization. So that's why, I tried to investigate it that way a bit. So the disco might be, you know, part of that. So it becomes a kind of cultural, social space where the beat is kind of functioning. Something like
so,
that?
Yeah. So you see rhythm more as the abstract, like, concept, and the vibration as the physical incarnation concept or something.
Yeah, I mean, of course, rhythm is also very physical. And the vibration, I'm sure there's a politics there that we could explore. And of course, the investigation of the lowrider, you know, brings me to certain ideological tensions, you know.
So basically, you see, rhythm is human-readable and vibration is sort of too fine to really understand directly.
Yes. No, I mean...
But they're really the same thing, no?
Well, that too, but there's differences, you know. Yes, of course, there's a... this is maybe the area of a kind of a sonic cultural science where the discourse is also about, kind of giving narrative to these kind of phenomena. So, of course, they're open to possibilities. So I wouldn't claim, that vibration is always only one thing. Any other thoughts? Or yes, David. Maybe for the others.
At the beginning of your lecture, I forgot exactly what the context was, but you said something about the metaphysical. Do you remember? Or you mentioned something being metaphysical, and but then that was like at the very beginning of your presentation this evening, and I don't know if you recall what the context of that was, but
it's the beginning of the rhythm text.
Was that it? Okay.
Yeah. It was just a kind of allusion to my experience of starting to play drums when I was 13.
Oh, okay. Okay, because I was just, I was thinking, of course, of the various discourses around the metaphysics and logocentrism, and if there was at some point, maybe that was for you an early departure for you from a kind of earlier philosophical discourse into something else that might be more discursive or more contemporary philosophically. I don't know, I was just curious if that was something for you personal. Like a personal reference for you, I guess.
Yeah.
If there was something else there around metaphysics or phenomenology or logocentrism or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, as you probably are aware, I mean, there's certainly a very large kind of perspective and literature in relationship to sound in terms of the metaphysical.
Right.
So that sound has a way of transcending the physical plane. So this is an existing, this is a kind of very dynamic field of thinking that, of course, I was interested in and continued to be curious about. But it does tend to be not sort of the space I enter.
Right, right. Yeah. But it's like you continue to expand upon these details in so many interesting directions. So I don't know. That was just a thought. I really kind of was. Maybe I'm reading too much into that reference or your use of that term. The other comment I guess I wanted to say is I liked your reference to the street and walking with John Travolta and sort of thinking of the space of the street, and maybe it has something to do with the comment that the first commentator said about masculinity, but just the space of the street as being kind of a predatory space or a space of anarchy. And I hadn't really thought about that before in relationship to Saturday Night Fever, I guess. But so thank you for that. But just thinking of rhythm and masculinity and walking and focusing on the shoes and just walking down the street and this kind of predatory space and the way you tied it into to rhythm and to marching and drumming. I mean, I thought that was really just a really interesting expansion of those ideas. So. Just a comment, I guess, on that.
Thank you, Dave.
Yeah.
Yes. No, definitely. I mean, there's. Yeah. I know. You're gonna probably rent that film tomorrow, right?
No, I don't think so. I think that was more than I needed to see this evening, but I'm sure other people in the audience will be running Netflix.
I know. You know? No, I had a whole idea to sort of you know. Yeah, write a whole Saturday Night Fever kind of project. I'm not sure yet if I'll explain. Yeah, there's lots there.
I had a question about ideology and vibration. You were talking about how vibration seems ideology-proof or possibly not close to ideology in some way. And that might be true, but once we switch it from vibration to vibes, good vibes, bad vibes, then that becomes closer to a kind of a political realm in some sense. And that's a kind of, I mean, even a few years ago, Musharraf from Pakistan was talking about how there were bad vibes being sent into the country at a certain point. So it even sort of escalated to a place where, you know, the president of a foreign country was talking about bad vibes. So I was wondering if vibes would be a way to think about how ideology and vibrations intersect.
Yeah.
Because vibration as a word does seem more immune to ideology than vibes.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Definitely, I mean, I sort of, it's very kind of interesting kind of phrase. And it also makes me think a little bit about particular kinds of works that use the idea of contamination. So to influence or infect a space, for instance, or a situation through a kind of vibe, through shifting the vibe with like, you know, invisible sources, whether that be particular kinds of frequencies, kind of ultrasound frequencies, or, you know, the kind of ideas also around like Muzak, you know, how Muzak conditions a space, you know, through this kind of sonic, you know, kind of perfume, and that this somehow influences our psyche and our kind of emotional self. So it kind of, it's sort of like, you know, changing the vibe of the space, the shopping mall or the scene.
This is a big history of the term, which I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a kind of political history in some sense.
Why is that there?
It's the kind of term one associates with a certain moment of American culture, but it may I have a feeling it's one of those terms that you can shift back like probably a century, but I don't know.
Yeah.
It seems hugely ideological and modernist. There's a kind of modern vibrational modernist, like futurism.
That kind of thing. Right. Visually there's a sense of
meaning. But there's also the other direction you could go in where it's ideological becomes frequency, then it becomes the kind of scientific sort of rational form of dealing with that.
Do we?
And there's one that's older. There's a huge spiritual history of vibration.
Yes, and of course, and vibration is.
There's something like that, but I mean, I'm just interjecting. Vibrating. Okay. My time will vibrate.
Okay. Well, maybe on that note of vibes, vibrations, and politics, we can say thank you to Brandon. Thank you for a wonderful lecture. We do have some bottles of wine, some Hendrick.